Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome to Murder Mile, a true crime podcast, an audio-guided walk featuring many of London's untold, unsolved, and long-forgotten murders, all set within London's West End. Today's episode is about the wealthy millionaire socialite Roberto Troyan, a gregarious, fun, and generous man, who, being gripped with grief and unable to cope, placed his life in the hands of someone he felt he could trust. And yet this greedy little man would bleed Roberto dry. Murder Mile is researched using original sources. It contains moments of satire, shock, and grisly details. And as a dramatization of the real events, it may also feature loud and realistic sounds, so that, no matter where you listen to this podcast, you'll feel like you're actually there. My name is Michael, I am your tour guide, and this is Murder Mile. Episode 68, Roberto Troyan, Grief, Guilt, and Greed. Today, I'm standing in Mount Street, W1. Three streets southwest of the shoe store where Sedu Dirasuba was stabbed to death. Two streets east of the Intercontinental Hotel where exiled Iraqi Prime Minister Abd al-Razzaq Saeed al-Naif was assassinated. One street south of the Millennium Hotel where former Russian spy Alexander Litvinenko was poisoned by incompetent KGB agents. And one street east of the cruel and painful abortion of Elsie Goldsmith. Coming soon to Murder Mile. Mount Street is a pretentious little side street in the heart of the exclusive district of Mayfair. Enveloped by embassies, flanked by five-star hotels, peppered with millionaires' penthouses, and awash with tiny art galleries. All with no customers, only three pictures, and a zoned-out receptionist staring into space. Surrounded by half-empty stores of designer this, exclusive that, and shapeless tat by names no one gives a shit about. On a street packed with Bentleys, Rolls-Royces, Lambos, and even a bright gold smart car whose license plate is worth 10 times more than the car itself. Mount Street is wealthy, but soulless, vacuous, and dead. It's like a wannabe Rodeo Drive, only with drizzle. A stale Saint-Tropez, only with a sea of wigs. And with so many facelifts, it looks like every local has been caught in an icy breeze. Situated halfway along is a four-story red and brown brick building at 101 Mount Street. A pristine mansion block with 15 exclusive apartments, complete with a maid service and a concierge. And where the worst crime you can imagine happening might revolve around a poodle's coiffure, a pair of red trousers, and a deeply affronted man called Farquhar. And although each flat is worth £1.3 million, flat 6 at 101 Mount Street was recently sold for a paltry £300,000. As it was here, on Friday the 8th of March 2013, having seen that Roberto Troyan was grieving, a greedy financial advisor would take everything, from his last penny to his final breath. Roberto was larger than life, gregarious, funny, and astute. The kind of man where, once you met him, you could never forget him. And although he came from wealth, he was good, decent, and caring. Born in Italy in 1950, Roberto Charles Troyan was one of two children to Bob, a former US Army officer who later made his money in shipping, and Marie, a doting mother, who he would never fail to call each and every day. And with his one sister, Rosalie, they both enjoyed a happy and loving upbringing. Raised in the US city of Boston, although Robert, as he preferred to be called, would retain a Bostonian twang to his voice throughout his life, blessed with a flair for design and a deep love of Britain, having graduated from art school in 1983, Robert moved to London. But it wasn't just his sweet face, twinkling eyes, and mop of dyed red hair which made him stand out. As amongst his friends, it was his charm, his kindness, and his talent. And although his life was good, it wasn't complete. That same year, Robert met 30-year-old Anthony Feldman, a successful interior designer and architect from Johannesburg, with many high-profile commissions and celebrity clients. And being partners in work, having found true love together, Robert and Anthony became partners in life. As a couple, Robert and Anthony complemented each other beautifully. As with a passion for art and a love of antiques, they lived in a stylish penthouse apartment in Hertford Street, Mayfair. Furnished with fine art, plush carpets, intricate figurines, and a painting by Picasso. It was a perfect partnership. With the fastidious and meticulous Anthony in control of the food, the fun, and the finances, and the gregarious Robert, like a beaming beacon of light, who made everyone who entered their home feel welcome and warm, bestowing upon them all hugs, compliments, and kisses. Robert and Anthony's lavish dinners were infamous, a veritable who's who of society, with Anthony as the pianist, Robert as the raconteur, and the chilled champagne flowing freely. But being blessed with deep pockets and big hearts, they used their influence for good, raising funds for the homeless, the desperate, and the penniless. Being generous to everyone, whether celebrities, staff, or strangers. And although, being a big part of the social scene, they would holiday in a secluded cottage in Turkey, Robert only ever wanted to live in Mayfair, as here he felt safe. But sadly, this was not the case. Robert and Anthony were together for 22 years. They worked, ate, and slept side by side. And being very much in love, they were inseparable. But as two gay men, although they lived together, the law didn't see them as a couple and denied them any rights. So when the Civil Partnership Act of 2004 was passed, Robert and Anthony made it official and announced their engagement. Robert was blissfully happy, hopelessly in love, and soon to be married, as now his life would be complete. Only fate can be cruel. In October 2005, a few months before their wedding, Anthony felt a few twinges in his muscles, which he brushed off as just a bad back. But as his health hastily deteriorated, upon seeing a doctor and getting some tests, Anthony was diagnosed with an aggressive form of pancreatic cancer. On the 10th of December 2005, just 5 days after the law was passed, Robert and Anthony were married in a private ceremony in their Hereford Street flat, 8 days later, 52-year-old Anthony Feldman was dead. A memorial service was held at the nearby Grosvenor Chapel, and amongst a chorus of joyous songs and a sea of grieving faces, although Anthony was given the glorious send-off he truly deserved, being ashen-faced and distraught, Robert sobbed throughout and was barely able to stand. As with his husband gone, his love stolen, and his heart broken, this larger-than-life character looked tiny and frail. And as the invite stopped, the party ceased, and their friends drifted away, Robert was left alone. Their tiny spacious apartment was now a hollow, joyless void. Their fine art, a painful reminder of 22 years together. Their many photos, like cruel glimpses back at happier times. And every old anecdote he once regaled his enraptured friends with, now lost, gone, and never to be told. And with his smell on the pillow, his clothes in the cupboard, and his shoes by the door, everything reminded him of Anthony. As in the middle of their sumptuous suite, with his sweet smile sunken, his eyes red raw, and his confidence crushed, Robert sat alone, as the walls which once rang with joyous laughter now echoed with his solitary tears. As the sole beneficiary of Anthony's fortune, legally being a widower, the civil partnership had ensured that Robert's financial future was secure. But physically and emotionally, he was bankrupt. So unable to escape the grief, which hung in their apartment like a dense cloud of gloom, Robert moved from their spacious penthouse on Hertford Street into the more modest flat 6 at 101 Mount Street. And even though he had moved, the pain remained, as the grieving man struggled to cope. Anthony was his everything, and without him, Robert was at a loss. So with restaurants nearby, Robert would often eat out. And with his flat in disarray, he hired a maid. But with Anthony gone, being gripped in grief, his spending spiraled out of control. Unable to find happiness, Robert shopped. But the art he brought only made him more miserable. Sometimes he parted, but the late nights left him with nothing but bar bills and hangovers. And as a kind and lovely man, he lavished his friends with gifts, but with no control, his life became a blur. Wildly spending to conceal his grief, Robert's life was spiraling out of control. He knew that, and with his bank account rapidly dwindling, he did the sensible thing and sought out an experienced and respected advisor to handle his millions in the bank. And his name was David Jeffs. Originally from Peterborough, in 2008, Robert was introduced to David Jeffs, a financial advisor for a wealth management firm with a solid reputation called HFM Columbus. David looked as you'd expect a financial advisor to look, as with short dark hair, thick rimless glasses, and a boyishly smooth face. Unlike Robert, he didn't exude flamboyance. Instead, he was smart, quiet, and bookish. In a crisp white shirt, a plain blue suit, and brown suede shoes, although his style hinted at a man eager to break away from the stuffy demeanour of a chartered accountant, flourished in a Burberry scarf, tied in a way that GQ said was best, and clutching an old black leather briefcase with a brass clasp, not unlike something a Victorian doctor would carry, he hadn't got the personality to pull the fashion off. His dress sense aside, 31-year-old David Jeffs was experienced but unremarkable. Although recently divorced, He lived with his fiancée and six-year-old son in a tidy house on a quiet cul-de-sac in the pleasant village of Arnold in Nottingham. He had a car, a garden, a steady career, earning him a decent salary of £53,000 a year. And as expected from a financial advisor, his life was modest, safe, and good. Acting as his financial concierge, David started small by organizing Robert's spending, sorting out his direct debits, and streamlining his standing orders. With a sense of normality returning to his life, and eager to ensure the longevity of his wealth, David invested £1.2 million of Robert's money into Royal Scandia Life Insurance, a very stable, long-term investment. David Jeffs was a real straight arrow. Dull but indispensable, vapid but invaluable, staid but trusted. So much so that against the bank's wishes, Robert wrote David several blank checks to invest. By 2010, grief had taken its toll on Robert. And although he dressed at Ralph Lauren, had his hair styled by John Frieda's, and ate at Scots of Mayfair, having contracted a debilitating skin disease, the steroids caused his weight to balloon. Being reliant on his maid to do his cooking, washing and cleaning, having packed on several stone, she also had to support him as he walked from his flat to the ground floor. Robert was vulnerable, disabled and frail. An ailing man with an extravagant lifestyle, expensive tastes, a wild spending habit, and an inexhaustible bank balance. And now, he was dependent on others. By contrast, David Jeffs lived a modest life. One house, one car, one child, and one girlfriend. With a 9-to-5 job, working 5 days a week, with one holiday a year, and with his clothes by Marks and Spencer's, his food by Asda, his art by IKEA, and occasional nights out at the Flicks, there was no comparison. Dealing with the finances of the rich and famous, David wanted to live a life of luxury. But being an unimaginative and risk-averse man, already living beyond his modest means, with an ex-wife and a child to support, as well as several credit cards, loans and overdrafts, he knew that life was out of his reach. For David Jeffs, there would be no all-night parties, no stays in five-star hotels, and no tables at Michelin-starred restaurants. He would have no fleet of sports cars, no exotic holidays, and no celebrity friends. With no champagne, no caviar, no chauffeur, and no cocaine. He wanted the best, but the best he could achieve was mediocre. In comparison to Robert, David was nothing. And yet his client was rich, vulnerable, grieving, and best of all, trusting. With complete control of Robert's bank account, over the next 2 years, David embarked on a shopping spree which would make a Saudi prince blush. He spent £1,100 at a VIP polo event, £1,200 at China White's nightclub, £1,400 on two rugby tickets, £19,500 in one night at the Spearmint Rhino Lap Dancing Club, quaffing £400 bottles of Cristal, and treating himself to two Lotus sports cars for £72,500. And although this happened at the height of the recession, he claimed that his newfound good fortune was slowly down to sound financial investments. Being flush with cash, David holidayed in Las Vegas, Mauritius and Ibiza, dined out at London's most expensive hotels and restaurants, and in his modest home, he amassed a huge collection of guitars. Using the blank checks, David siphoned off £343,000 into his own account. lavishing his fiancée with a £15,000 wedding ceremony in October 2012. And just a few weeks before Robert's death, he used his ill-gotten gains to treat himself and his family to a trip to Centre Parks. David had bled his cash cow dry, but still he wanted more. As by February 2013, the financial advisor's life was a mess, as with barely £6 in his bank account and in debt to the taxman to £200,000, Robert's wealth wasn't just there to bail David out, but to cover his hopeless addiction to cocaine and ecstasy. In early March 2012, David cashed another blank check for £80,000. But this time, it bounced. Having confided to his maid, Davy Agonon, of his fears about his dwindling bank account, his evasive financial advisor, and how he was unable to withdraw any cash, with a lease on his flat up for renewal that week, Robert requested an urgent meeting with David the very next day at 3 p.m. Friday the 8th of March 2013 was a classic British weekday. The sun was absent, the sky was grey, and the gloomy grey streets were soaked in a persistent all-day drizzle. At 2:28 p.m, arriving a full 30 minutes too early, David Jeffs walked into the Oldley pub at 41 Mount Street, a few doors down from Robert's flat. Dressed in a crisp white shirt, a plain blue suit and brown suede shoes, with a brown Burberry scarf, his old battered briefcase and black leather gloves. Visibly pacing back and forth in the bar, David slugged back a stiff drink to steady his nerves, as not only would he need to explain the missing millions to Robert and the bank, but with nowhere to turn, as the broken, hopeless drug addict shook, he knew his lies would be unravelled, the thief would be exposed, and the consequences for his job, his wife, and his life would be huge. At 2:31 p.m, David called Robert's phone. As it often did, it went to voicemail.
Hi, this is Robert. Leave a message.
Robert, it's David. I'm a tad early. I popped by, but you're not in, so I'll try again in a bit. Cheers.
Only this was a lie. He hadn't been to the flat. This was part of his alibi. A few minutes later, David called at 101 Mount Street. He pressed the doorbell to flat 6. The intercom crackled. He was buzzed in by Robert. And as the CCTV caught him enter the communal hall, behind him the brass-covered door closed, and he ascended the stairs, out of sight. At 2:45 p.m, having spent less than 15 minutes in the building, David descended the stairs, alone. The CCTV recaptured him as he exited the street door and walked into Mount Street. At 2:57 p.m, he made another call to Robert's phone. Again it went to voicemail.
Hi, this is Robert. Leave a message.
Robert, it's David. I still can't get hold of you. I popped by, but got no reply. So, let's rearrange, okay? Cheers.
But again, this was a lie, and part of his alibi. Hopping into a taxi, David caught the 3:15 train from Waterloo and headed 45 minutes south to the suburban town of Guildford. The blackness of his gloves and the darkness of his blue suit disguising the oddly speckled stains which had splashed and splattered up his legs, arms and torso. At 5:36 p.m, David entered a BP garage outside Woking. He brought 20 black bin bags, 2 packets of wet wipes, and spending 10 minutes in the toilets, he exited dressed in a grey jumper, a light shirt, black trousers, and carrying a half-full bin bag. Later that day, having destroyed the bloodstained originals, he purchased an identical set of clothes. A white shirt, a blue suit, brown shoes, and a brown Burberry scarf. And from there, he headed home to his wife and child, as if nothing had happened. But something had happened. At 3:57 p.m., punctual as ever, Robert's faithful maid, Davy Agonon, opened the door to flat 6. As always, she called out his name to let him know she was there.
Robert!
But oddly, for a man who was kind and polite, he didn't reply. And as a large and unsteady man, who needed her assistance to simply descend a flight of stairs, it was unusual for him not to be in. So with each room spotless, no sounds heard, nothing out of place and no sign of Robert, Davy began her regular duties. The kitchen was small and pokey, being barely 7 feet deep by 6 feet wide, including the sink, the cooker and sides. It stood only two people at a push. And with no windows, one door, and being set dead centre in the flat, surrounded by three rooms, outside of these walls, the room was soundless. As Davy entered the kitchenette, her path was blocked as the door was wedged. Being little, she pushed it hard, only it wouldn't budge. But through a crack, she saw on the floor a pair of legs slumped, still and silent. Concerned for her ailing employer, she called,
"Robert, you okay?"
But he didn't reply. And then she noticed the blood. Two builders working one floor above heard her screams. Racing downstairs, they barged the blocked door aside with brute force, shoving Robert's 20-stone bulk aside, only to see a scene of utter horror. Having been attacked from behind, whilst graciously making a cup of tea for himself and his guest, as a frail and disabled man who was barely able to stand, let alone defend himself from a frenzied and crazed assailant, Robert had been repeatedly battered about the head and face, with such force and ferocity that, based on his injuries, initially the police thought he'd been shot. Unable to evade the rapid savage blows which repeatedly rained down on the grief-stricken man, with his killer blocking his only exit, Robert was beaten bloody by an addict with nothing more to gain and nothing left to lose. And as his last drop of life splattered up the shiny stainless steel surfaces, being barely conscious, blood pooled about his head as his killer fled. The paramedics were called, but having suffered several deep fractures to his skull, his left cheek, his jaw and his eye sockets, 63-year-old Roberto Charles Troyan was pronounced dead at the scene. Believing he had weaved an intricate alibi, David's web of lies were uncovered by a trail of bank statements, an addict's habit, and several blank checks. And with his clothes and the murder weapon missing, his guilt was proved by a single drop of Robert's blood, found inside the one item which David had failed to destroy: his old black leather briefcase. On the 20th of March 2013, 36-year-old David Jeffs was arrested and charged with murder. Being tried at Croydon Crown Court, the jury found him guilty of murder, and he was sentenced to serve a minimum of 24 years in prison, with an additional 6 years for fraud. Robert was a good man, kind, loving, generous and gregarious. But grieving his lost love and struggling to cope as his health and his happiness was taken away, he placed his life in the hands of someone he felt he could trust: his financial advisor. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for listening to Murder Mile. If you're a Murky Miler, Stay tuned for another thrilling installment of Extra Mile, where I may, if you're lucky, look out of my window and shout, "Oi, slow down!" to a passing boat and grumble a bit about holiday boaters. But before that, here's my recommended podcast of the week.
Hi, I'm Matt.
And I am Jesse. So, like, what is American Slacker, I guess, right?
The highest amount of dick jokes per episode per podcast.
We've been on the air for 57 straight years.
57 straight years of dick jokes.
Things constantly soaring over my head.
And you pulling my chain in your weekly weird news.
We're also cannabis friendly. We kind of sneak it in there, almost like you're lacing the brownies at the family reunion.
It's the ride of your motherfucking life.
Fucking 11 when there's only 10 on the dial.
Weapons of mass destruction.
It's a threat to society.
Food assaults.
Yeah, that happens too sometimes. An ostrich took a lit match into a fireworks factory.
I don't even know where to go with that one.
No, that's our third story.
Oh my God. America, what are you doing?
There's always someone dumb getting fucked over.
Well, you know, they should have never gave raccoons rights, in my opinion.
Oh my God. You can help us. You can help everyone.
Download our shit now.
We're second America. America.
The neighborhood is unsafe, the streets unlit. While others sleep soundly, you lie awake because you know the truth. You know that, no matter where you go, there's always a chance that a monster is in your midst. The darkness that runs deep within our own veins, the evil found in even the sweetest of souls, sometimes comes to light. And when it does, the result is a person that takes on that evil, that wears it proudly, and becomes part of the darkness itself. I am Aaron from Devil We Know podcast. And on our true crime show, we dive into the scariest corners of our past and present to reveal the devil we know. A father, a mother, a brother, a sister, and anyone, anywhere who hides in plain sight, living a life of bloody secrets while living just next door. Come check us out and hear the chilling, true stories about the devils we know.
A huge thank you goes out to my new Patreon supporters, who are Jack Clark, Dominique Simpson, Kirsty Reynolds, James Rose, and Ben and Rosie from the They Walk Among Us podcast. And a huge thank you to Kirsty McPhee Good and family, who came on my Murder Mile walk recently and very kindly presented me with a rather lovely hand-painted Murder Mile flower pot full of tasty tea and cakey goodness. Yum. And also a quick hello to everyone I met at the London True Crime Meetups, which was hosted by They Walk Among Us and Generation Y podcast. It gave me a great chance to meet and chat to some lovely listeners, hello to you all, as well as to Colleen from Misconduct, Paul from True Crime Enthusiast, Jess from Outlines, and Kate and Georgie from Nothing Rhymes with Murder. It was a great night. If you missed it, you were missed. Don't forget, if you want to see what the murder locations look like, on the day that each podcast is released, I upload a blog for that episode, with a map, location videos, photos, and much more. There's a link to each blog in the show notes. Murder Mile was researched, written and performed by myself, with the main musical themes written and performed by Eric Stein and John Books of Cult with No Name. Thank you for listening, and sleep well.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And that is that done. Good, that was good. That wasn't too bad. It's pissing down outside, so I was a little bit worried that... Because if there's trees over me, normally I hear... But it's today is classic British drizzle day, which is great. So it's been really quiet, so you haven't really heard it, so that's really good. Right, it's me here. Hello, it's Michael. It's Extra Mile time. We're going to discuss. If you're new to Extra Mile, this is the extra bit afterwards. If you notice, it's unscripted, hence blah 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 blah. I can do all that. I'm going to tell you some stuff that you might not know about the case, which may not have gone in. I'm going to make myself a cup of tea very shortly. Although my coffee's still warm, I kind of powered through that recording. How long did that take me? It was quite quick, actually. Quite quick, I think, because I wrote it in a not a flowery way, so it was easy to write. I'm just going to open a window. It's not a hot day, but I just want to get a little bit of fresh air in. There we go. Oh, open the front door. That's better. Bit of fresh air. Lovely. Oh, it was piddling down earlier on, but now it's okay. Am I going to have a cake yet? No, I'm not. Although I have to say, I think I just mentioned in that podcast that about Kirsty very kindly gave me that lovely really nicely detailed hand painted black flower pot with the Murder Mile design on there, and I thought it was a print because it looked so good, but then I realised it was hand painted. God, it looks really good. Even like the footprint is really detailed. So, but yeah, I've eaten most of the cakes already. I've got one cake to go. Oh, I had the coconut one. It was coconut coated with a fruity filling, which was really nice. And then the next one was a marble cake, which I annihilated. And now I've got one left. And I'm not too sure what one it is. I'm looking forward. That will go by the end of the day. Trust me, that will go. Whew. So how are you all? Are you all good? You all good? Keeping yourselves busy. I think for most people, I don't know, I don't have kids, but apparently it's summer holidays. I always thought summer holidays was the end of the month. I thought it was like end of the month, and then it was, but apparently not. Apparently it started already. I know that by the time you get this episode, you'll be like, what's Michael talking about? Because this episode goes out 8th of August. Yeah, but for me, what date is it now? This is 18th of July. Yeah, I'm way ahead. I'm trying to get myself ahead. I'm saying next week, but for you, it's already happened. I'm in the future. don't ask me what the lottery numbers are. So I'm yet to record them. What I was going to do, I was going to record the Meander Mile episodes, and then I was going to record this one. But when I went out into Soho to record the Meander Mile episode with my kind of little digital recorder that I've got, which is very nice. It's a stereo recording. You can plop it down. It's got a windsock on it, and you can plop it down, and it picks up lots of sounds from different, like from really. It's great fun. I sometimes walk with it, my earplugs in, listening to it, because you can hear conversations like from way down the street. It's really powerful. But when I got there, I realised it's great for distance and stereo, but it's not good for picking up kind of mono tracks. Like, so when I stood in the middle of Charing Cross Road trying to record an opening, an intro to the first Meander Mile that you would have already heard, but that's not the original, that's the version I'm going to do tomorrow. I couldn't pick up my audio well, so I've had to buy myself a little clip mic, a little lapel mic with a windsock on it, so I can record with that. So we'll see how that goes. So I'm still yet to record what was it? Meander Mile Soho, Meander Mile Covent Garden. They are written. I just haven't recorded them yet. Hopefully the weather will be nice tomorrow. We'll see how that goes. August 8th. So why did I get onto that? That's really weird. Why did I get onto that? Yeah. So this is where
Well, this goes out in 3 weeks' time. But if you're listening to it now, I recorded this 3 weeks ago. Unless you're listening to this in a year's time, then this is all irrelevant. So who cares? What's going on? Right, I'm here. I'm just checking my time. Okay. So that was episode 68, Roberto Troyan, Grief, Guilt and Greed. I stumbled across this ages ago. This was obviously because I live in London. It was in the newspapers. It wasn't really covered a huge amount. I can't remember what had happened. Something was happening around that time, so it kind of got pushed away, and it was kind of, you know, there was probably some terrorism going on or something like that. Something bad had probably happened. So I think it got washed under the carpet. I remember reading about it in the Standard and going, oh, that's interesting. But by that point, I hadn't decided to set up Murder Mile. Murder Mile wasn't something I was planning to do. So I just, and I think by that point, I'd stopped. I was just about to be made redundant. That's why I was focused elsewhere. I was thinking about what I was going to do with my life. That's why. That was 2013. Ooh, that was fun. So, yeah, I wasn't really thinking about Murder Mile. I wasn't really looking at stories. It was, you know, it wasn't even on my horizon. It was just something to read in the paper. I read it and went, yeah, there we go. Didn't really know much about it, but I think when I saw the photo of Roberto Troyan, and then I saw the photo of David Jester. You know, sometimes you make judgments about people when you look at them. I think instantly I kind of... whether it's what the press had chosen to choose as pictures, they'd chosen a really nice picture of Roberto where he looks smiley and he very cheerful and, you know, looked like a really nice guy. And then if you go onto my website, the blog's out today, go and have a look at it. The pictures are on there. Oh, no, it won't be on my blog because I can't... Oh. I can't copyright. I can't use it because it's copywritten by one of the press organisations. So you'll have to go to either my Twitter account, I can use it, or if you join the Murder Mile Facebook group, the discussion group, I'll have the photo on there because I can legally put it on there. I can't put it on my website. It's confusing. Don't ask me why. I once put some pictures which were copywritten, which I didn't know that, on my website. They were only tiny. I used four of them and I was charged £300 for those pictures. And then I looked at my blog and went, holy shit, I've got almost 1,000 photos that I took off Google on there. So if you have a website and you've gone on Google and you've gone, oh yeah, I'll borrow that picture. Don't. Really don't. They're not yours. Basically the rule is if you don't own the copyright, you can't have it. You can't use it. There's a grey area at the moment that says people are like, well, how can we put it on Instagram and Twitter and Facebook? And there's a grey area at the moment. It's like they can't fine you for it, because if they fine you for it, then they have to fine Facebook and Twitter, and, you know, they have to attack high and then they'll come down on you. So at the moment it's a grey area. But if you own a website, if you've got a website or a blog, weirdly, the rules are different for a blog. If you've got a blog and you're using pictures or music or footage that isn't yours, be very careful. You were in shit. I was in shit that one day when they said, you owe us £300, and I thought, well, this is a scam. And then I checked it out and I went, oh, shit, it's not a scam. And that was four photos and they were tiny and I barely used them. And it was just, I had to go through my blog and rip all the pictures out. So, if you're on my what's it called, Patreon account, they're on there as well. They post them very early. Because it's on Patreon, I can get away with this. All the pictures that are on there are crime scene photos. Well, not crime scene photos, often crime scene photos. For this one, I've put all the CCTV pictures on there. There's quite a few that show David Jeffs as he approaches 101 Mount Street, as he's in the Audley pub just before he makes the call. There's another photo of him at the BP garage just after he's got changed. There's another photo of him carrying the black carrier bag with the bloody clothes in it. So they're all on there. As I was about to say, there are pictures of Roberto Troyan and David Jeffs. They won't be on my website. They'll be on the social media. But have a look at those. You can really see that Roberto looks like a really nice man. Apparently he really was as well. Whereas David Jeffs, you look at him and you go, he looks like a serial killer. He really does. He's got that kind of Dennis Nielsen quality about him. So have a look at those pictures. And that kind of summed it up. So actually, when I was going through this story, I approached the story. I didn't know much about it, except he was murdered and where the murder happened and the location still existed. But as I was going through it, it was really obvious of how to write this, because obviously even though Roberto was wealthy, really nice man, lots of good friends, people really liked him. His life got quite sad because, you know, he found someone he loved. Then the law happened that said, okay, now you can legally be married to this man. And then he died 5 days later. In the press, this is why I hate using newspapers. The press said that he was the first couple. They were the first couple to legally marry in London. That's complete bullshit. They were married 5 days later, but they were one of the first. But don't forget, in those first 5 days, a lot of people did get married, and rightly so. So that was that story. There's a couple of pieces that I didn't put in for time. To be honest, most of the information I put in. If you go on the website as well, I have put this on my website because I can legally get around it. I took some photos outside the building and of the street. There's a location video there as well, so you can see what Mount Street looks like. Obviously, you can see the front door, the glass-fronted brass. Oh, I can't speak. The door that's covered in brass. Say those. I've been struggling to say words all day. The brass-fronted front door is there. I couldn't go inside, obviously, because it's a private residence. But of the 15 flats that are there, number 5 was up for sale. This is number 6, but number 5 was up for sale. And when I looked, they were identical. So there was a nice picture of the front room, or as they called it, the drawing room. So I've got that picture on there, so you can see this kind of size of it and what it looks like. They're very luxurious flats. And also I put in there a layout of the flat, so you can see how it's shaped out. There is kind of the living room to the left, to the top is like a second bedroom, to the right is the main bedroom, then there's a hallway, and right in the middle is a little kitchen. And you can see the dimensions of the kitchen, you can see where the door is, you can see, you know, where the way everything's shaped. So it kind of makes sense when you listen to the story. But I removed a couple of bits to do with the trial because I felt that we'd wrapped up the story enough. But there's more that kind of tells you a lot more about the arrogance of David Jeffs. There's a real arrogance about him. So he pleaded not guilty to fraud and murder. There were two charges on that. After his arrest, police discovered evidence that Jeffs had been taking ecstasy and cocaine and keeping the extent of his drug usage from his wife. Jeffs told police that he was Mr. Troyan's £1,000 a week financial concierge. That's what he said he got paid. So that's £4,000 a month. And that he had been paid 2 years' salary in advance. Chinny Recon. So that would be, what's the maths on that? That'd be £100,000. Is that right? Yeah, £100,000. Yeah, which still doesn't explain the £363,000 that he transferred from that account and the two Lotuses and the holidays. But passing sentence, Mr. Justice Rabinder Singh QC said Jeffs was a smooth talker who creamed off his victim's savings to fund a greedy and extravagant lifestyle. Prosecutor Mr. Edward Brown QC told the defendant, "You knew you killed Roberto Troyan and needed a new set of clothing." But Jeffs replied, "That's not true." It was true. He said, "I never went into the flat on that Friday," insisted Jeffs. Dismissing the suggestion, he looked more dishevelled on CCTV, which recorded him leaving the building. Jeffs said, "Except for my scarf not being tucked into my jacket, I'd say I look the same." And many times I felt the weight. Oh, yeah. Because he was being cross-examined, he said, "And many times I felt the entire weight of the Metropolitan Police Force is against me." Really? Yeah, it's the police's fault, isn't it? It's not your fault. Not your fault that you stole almost what was, yeah, roughly around £500,000 from what they could find so far. This is just what's listed, but, you know. We don't actually know the full amount of what was taken out of Roberto's account. Asked why he lied to the police, this I deliberately took out because it's slightly confusing. Asked why he lied to the police, Jeff said, "I wanted to avoid a connection with Sorry, that's a burpee. I wanted to avoid a connection with the man I met at Robert's place and all the madness that surrounded his life. Jeff's told the jury. There was a lot of discussion in the jury about Roberto's life, about his many sexual partners. I know a lot of his friends online have kind of said he never took cocaine, but there's quite a few people who said after his life started to collapse, he started to meet with people who weren't the kind of the people he'd met with before, the kind of the high profilers. He started meeting with a lot of people who were quite low rent. There's some articles in there which says about this guy who we met who was a drug dealer, who's actually served time in prison. And so, yeah, it's hard to tell what's true and what's not true, really. David Jeffs actually played on a lot of this during the trial. According to Crown Court, prosecutor David Brown QC... Where am I going? Yeah, we've done that. Prosecutor said that Jeffs carried out a cold and calculated deception. As mentioned, Jeffs was tried for 24 years for murder and a further 6 for fraud to be served concurrently. As he was taken away, he mouthed, "I love you," to his wife, Sherry. Whether they're still together, we don't know. If she's got any sense, hopefully not. Now, as mentioned above, there was reference to a mystery man that was there. This was used a lot in the trial. I deliberately took this out of this episode because it just throws it off. It just, you know... if this was a case about... if this was a two-parter and we did one episode about, you know, what the trial said and then another one about the truth, we could do that. But this was just something that David Jeffs and his lawyers were using as kind of, as always happens, uses as an excuse, saying it wasn't me, it was a mystery man that no one knows and you can't find him and he's responsible. David Jeffs would later claim that a blood-stained mystery man had confronted him at Roberto Troyan's apartment when he arrived for the meeting. Although there were no signs of forced entry at the apartment and no items of high value had been taken or touched. He told the police there was no answer at Mr. Troyan's door, but after the deceased's blood was found on his briefcase, he claimed to have had a confrontation on the landing with an angry, blood-stained mystery man. In a desperate bid to explain away damning DNA evidence, Jeffs told the jury the man was probably a rent boy or an angry pimp. This was plainly a... this was plainly a wholly false account. It was either invented to cater for the blood that had come. It was invented to cater for the blood that had, in truth, I hate when people do add the words "in truth" in the middle of a sentence, come from his own conflict with Mr. Troyan and Mr. Troyan's wet blood during the attack. Phew. There we go. What else is there? Yes. So, what's missing from the story is the murder weapon. Obviously, David Jeffs destroyed the clothes that he was wearing. But also, we don't know what the murder weapon is, because that seems to have disappeared as well. It must have been in the bag that he was using, the black bin bag that he put his clothes in, and destroyed it when he got rid of the clothes. Or... he may have destroyed it as he was in the taxi going to Waterloo or on the train from Waterloo to Guildford. It's never been found, and the pathologist was unable to confirm what it was. In the statement, it was said that when Robert was found on the floor, there was kind of a tray found on his head, which was bloodstained as well, but the tray wasn't broken at all. A dinner tray. If it would have been used to batter him about the head, that would have been broken. But it wasn't broken at all. And they said that he was hit over the head with something that was heavy and blunt. Whether David Jeffs brought this with him, we don't know. It's still a little bit sketchy in here whether this was a premeditated attack, whether he'd turned up that day and decided to do that. Which I still find a little bit weird, because if it wasn't premeditated, why would you make that call in advance and say, oh, I just tried to call for you, but you weren't in, and turn up half an hour early? That, I would say, is premeditation. But in the court, they had to say it was unsure whether it was premeditated or not. So whether he actually brought a weapon with him, we don't know. But if it wasn't, let's assume, we're going to have to assume because we don't know what it is. If it was something blunt and heavy and he hadn't brought it with him, it must have been something that he grabbed in the kitchen, because that's where they were. They were in the kitchen when the attack happened. So it must be something like a potato masher or a pan or a rolling pin or... I think what else there is in the kitchen that would it can't be anything too big, because he'd have to take it, because he would have, if it was big, he would have left it with him, so it'd have to be something easy to grab. Yeah, must be something like that. So I'm looking into my kitchen at the moment to see what else there is. Pan, kettle, you wouldn't use a kettle, silly. It'd have to be a utensil, wouldn't it? So it's one of those that he would have used as a murder weapon. So, there we go. That was Extra Mile for today. Hope you enjoyed that. It was a little bit shorter one than planned, because normally I sit there and I go, oh, I'll put all these details in. But we used all the details in the story, and then I don't really have much to say today, because I'm going to start editing this, and then go into town, pick up my new microphone so I can start recording the Meander Miles. And if they go well, we'll do those. But so you've got these. This is your episode 68. I've planned the next 10. So they've all been researched. So I'm sitting down to do those. So that will take... Where will that take us to? That will take us to kind of October-ish. There might be the Meander Mile in Rye. I might do that. When I'm at the wedding, there might be another Meander Mile in Brighton I'm thinking about doing, so that'll be October time as well. Then we will have a couple of episodes, probably 5 or 6 of Mini Mile, and then we will do the multi-part series, and that will take us through till the new year. And then what I'm going to do in January, I'm actually going to take January off. I'm going to go and have a nice little bit of a holiday. That'd be nice. I'm thinking no one will be on holiday, so I'm just going to disappear somewhere, go somewhere cheap. That'd be nice. And then February, get back into the archives and start all again. So I'm looking forward to my holiday. I haven't had a holiday in 5 years. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to that. Anyway, that was Murder Mile, Extra Mile, blah de blah de blah. I'm going to have some tea. I'm going to have some cake. Life is good. Hope you're all well. Be good. Speak to you soon. Tatty bye. Bye.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.